you don't, I've wasted an awful lot of time reading.
No, I think I sure would like you to talk about it.
Which end do you want to start from?
Let's start at the top one.
Let's start at Paradise come out.
Absolute mind and Sunday.
How long will it take? Start where you want to start and bail both ways, you know?
Huh?
How long will it take you to come down?
Well, I noon tomorrow.
How fast do you want me to come?
Well, on the
pilot, I can make a request.
All right, let's have it.
I got to leave right about 5 o'clock.
We'll do the job in an hour and a half.
So, start somewhere where I can understand it in that hour and a half.
All right.
And then after that, you can take these folks and gone farther.
Since this is going to be serious, we might as well get some answers taken in here. Burke warned me that the group had been considering mine. And I promised I'd talk a little about mine. Going back to the beginning, this whole thing starts, and of course when we talk about starts, we're putting time language into eternity, which is about as big a distortion as we can engage in. But if we don't distort this, we're not going to do any thinking whatsoever. God projects himself in antipodal directions. He produces opposites. He produces a being equal to himself, spiritually and personally. And then he produces impersonal, non-spiritual paradise. He produces the absolute person and the absolute machine. He produces the physical center of all material creation and the perfect spiritual revelation of his personal and spiritual nature. And this was done by the Father's unfettered will and factualized when his personal will coordinated these dual realities by mind. Or, again to quote the text, I prepared my lesson. In the eternity of the past, when the Universal Father gave infinite personality expression of his spirit self in the being of the Eternal Son, simultaneously he revealed the infinity potential of his non-personal self as paradise. Non-personal and non-spiritual paradise appears to have been the inevitable repercussion to the Father's will and act, which eternalized the original Son. Thus did the Father project reality in two actual phases, the personal and the non-personal, the spiritual and the non-spiritual. The tension between them in the face of will to action by the Father and the Son gave existence to the conjoint actor, the infinite spirit, and the central universe of material worlds and spiritual beings. Well, here's the situation which made mind inevitable. In the infinite nature of God the Father, there could not possibly exist duality of reality, such as physical and spiritual. But the instant we look aside from the infinite levels and absolute reality of the personal values of the Paradise Father, we observe the existence of these two realities, matter and spirit, and recognize that they are fully responsive to his personal presence, In him, all things consist. The moment you depart from the unqualified concept of the infinite personality of the Paradise Father, you must postulate mind as the inevitable technique of unifying the ever-widening divergence of these dual universe manifestations of the original monothetic creator personality, the first source and center. Now there's our kickoff for mind. For whatever reason, God elected to project actual reality as opposites, as the absolute thing and the absolute value. And they are integrated by mind, which gives rise to absolute meanings. I like the word thing, meaning, and value as we consider matter, mind, and spirit. When you have matter or thing in contrast to spirit or value, they don't touch out here. The spiritual value doesn't impinge on the material thing at any point. Both touch intellectual meanings. And one of the greatest statements in these papers is the concept of thing, meaning, and value, and of our different approach to the domain of thing, meaning, and value. If you're working with things, use reason. Be a materialist. If you surely want to set up a physical reaction, then establish a physical cause. It works every time. If you're sick, get a doctor. Don't pray. If you're hungry, get food. Don't pray. On the other hand, if you're in the domain of values, all your reason in the world won't help you. There's where faith operates. There's where love operates. You can't quantify values. There's no mass to love. There's no amplitude. There's no velocity. There's no wavelength to love. Numbers are ridiculous. If you have so many children, you've got budgetary problems. But you have no love problems. Because each time a new child comes along, where does the new love come from? Do you take it from the other children? No. You have a new expression, an individualized expression of love for that child. And within reason, I think this would go right on to encompass a very large family. If you had a dozen children, you'd love each one individually, wouldn't you? And you would not have to subtract from the earlier to give to the later. You see, the concept of number has no meaning in the area of value. With things, we try to use reason. We use mathematics. We evolve a scientific approach to the problems of matter. With values, we use faith. We have love. We're dealing with non-mathematical concepts. But in between, we have mind. We attempt to use logic. We try to evolve a philosophy. Philosophy, well, you could describe this thing as a water. No, that isn't too good either. Philosophy is bivalent. It reaches out on the one hand for the thing, and on the other hand for the value. And here's where we try to think through to work out a reasonable explanation for the laws of things and the laws of values. This is the function of mind out here in time and space. On Paradise, mind does not unify thing and value because Paradise is too close to God. Paradise, the isle, the place, the thing, manifests energy. The papers give us a name for the non-spiritual energy of the Paradise Isle. It's called Manota. The eternal sun manifests spirit. And we are told, in effect, that if we had an ammeter, voltmeter, and we could test out one energy and then test out the other, we could not tell one from the other. The only way we can tell, the only difference we make is one of concept. If the energy comes from the material Isle of Paradise, we call it Manota. If it emanates from the spiritual sun, we call it Paradise Spirit. But they're in perfect synchrony, and they can be identified, they can be separately identified only if you know their source. See, they're too close to God. And in Him, there is no duality of energy. There is no material energy or spiritual energy, just pure energy. Now, as we come out into the central universe, this is the universe that people long for unconsciously when they say, if God is all good and if God is all powerful, then how come the world is a mess if He made it? He didn't make it directly. But this is the universe He did make. And this universe operates in flawless perfection. This is the pattern universe, which evolution is trying to duplicate slowly and laboriously. This is the universe God set up as an objective. In this universe, matter and spirit are not the same. They're quite different. But they're in perfect synchrony. There is no clash between matter and spirit in this perfect universe. Nevertheless, there is a gap between them which must be bridged by mind. Out here in time and space, there's a hell of a gap between matter and spirit. And only by faith can you believe that the ultimate functions of the material level and the ultimate purposes of the spiritual level are synchronous. As we observe life on this planet, nature is quite indifferent to the welfare, health, happiness, and well-being of man. Mind has a function out here in time and space. Out here in time and space, spirit has been handicapped. Matter has been given a head start. Out here in time and space, energy matter is dominant. It was here first. The nebulae long preceded the arrival of spiritual beings. Energy matter is dominant except in one place, where you have a personal creature with free will who can make decisions, relative free will. In such personal creatures, spirit is striving for the mastery. And what tool does spirit use? Mind. Spirit cannot control matter, but mind can. And in a personal creature, will can decide to subordinate mind to spirit. Or as the papers put it more succinctly, in the evolutionary time-space creations, energy matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. There's the big bogey. Zoroaster tried to symbolize it in the struggle between light and darkness. The Middle Ages portrayed the struggle between God and the devil. The papers put it on an impersonal basis. Spirit is trying to come out on top, having been handicapped. Spirit can do this only through the use of mind. And spirit can dominate mind only if the personal choosing of the personal creature so wills. Is there an alternative? Sure. Mind can dominate matter without subordinating mind to spirit. This is the mess we're in today in the world. We've begun to unlock the storehouse of the secrets of nature, and we are literally scared spitless. Aren't we? Because this mind is not subordinated to spirit. And we're not sure about this. We don't trust scientists. We don't trust these techniques. in Chicago and look down Michigan Avenue. I love this city. It's dirty, it's ugly, and all that, but it's my hometown. I grew up there. And I thought, gee, it took 150 years to build this city, and we can smash it in 150 minutes now. We can level it into rubble. That, to me, is the broad overview of the function of mind, starting out on paradise and coming right down here into the lives of individual human beings. Let's go back to paradise. How does God think with mind? He has no mind. Mind doesn't appear until we have the third person of deity, who's the source of mind. God thinks with something which is ancestral to mind. As the papers say, spirit is conscious in the absence of all mind endowment. Mind does not have to be added to spirit to produce consciousness. What does the eternal Son think with? Not mind, because he and the Father are the direct ancestors of the source of mind, the third source and center. And here is a fascinating statement. Neither is paradise conscious, as mortal man could ever possibly understand such a term. But this absolute machine, which God built for the same reason that we build machinery, to perform routine, repetitive control operations, this absolute material center of the physical universes is in some way a knowing machine. This is not an unconscious piece of machinery. But it's not consciousness as we could ever understand the term. But paradise is in some way intelligent. Do you get that concept? Isn't that beautifully stated? Neither is paradise conscious, as mortal man could ever possibly understand such a term. Which to me says, paradise is in some manner minded. But again, this is not mind as we know it, because paradise was there before the third source and center appeared. Again, using time language to discuss eternity events. With the appearance of the third source and center and the central universe, we come up against the concept of three realities which have quantity and quality: matter, mind, and spirit. One reality which has no quantity of expression, personality. That's the fourth reality. It's qualitatively observable, but not quantitatively measurable. But these other three can be measured both in terms of quality and quantity. We try to measure quantity of mind down here. I partly make my living assaying such measurements. We speak of pints, quarts, and gallons of brains, which is a simple way of talking about IQ. How do we get our mind? It's a long step down from the absolute mind of the third source and center to the functioning mind of animals, humans, and secondary midwares. We have almost the lowest form of mind, not quite. There's one below ours. And now let's start at the bottom and work up, shall we? We might as well play this piano keyboard back and forth. Does man have the lowest form of mind? The answer is no. Animals have less than we have. And the lower grade animals have less than the higher grade animals. And the lowest type of animal life still has more mind of a different quality than vegetative life. Is a tree intelligent? Certainly it is. Have you ever seen the engineering job a tree does when its root structure is threatened with erosion? It's a magnificent piece of engineering. And the tree is using the lowest form of mind, mechanical, non-teachable mind. What does that mean? It means that every tree will react in the same fashion, given the same stimulus. This is a mechanical response, but not unintelligent. The tree will always try to keep upright, and it will modify its root structure to fight gravitational pull, to always try to keep upright as you erode away. This mind, I think, is confined to the vegetable kingdom. When it says non-teachable, it means you can never teach a tree to respond in any way except this one way. And every tree will respond in exactly that way. The response is perfectly predictable. The tree will fight any deviation from the perpendicular. This mind emanates from the third source and center, is ministered by some of the indirect progeny of the third source and center, by the master physical controllers. These are non-spiritual beings whom I think of as mechanics. They're concerned with the material regulation of the material universes. They're master mechanics, and there's a lot of them. Where does the non-teachable mind give way to the teachable mind? I think it's at the borderline between the animal and the vegetable kingdoms. If you were to ask me, where do you put a sponge? I don't know. I think the sponge lives on the border. My uncle was born in a home, and they carefully avoided one bedroom because it was in Canada. And the rest of the house was in the United States, and they wanted him to be a citizen of this country. And I think sponges are like this farmhouse up in Upper Vermont. Where do you get the first definite manifestation of the lowest form of teachable mind? An amoeba. You can teach an amoeba. Use the word conditioning, which means the amoeba learns a new response. How do you do this? Simple experiment. Take a mild current, not enough to kill, but enough to feel. Put it in the solution. Let the amoeba get the shock. He'll swim around. He gets the shock again. Some amoeba are brighter than others. If he's a fairly bright amoeba, after the second or third shock, he'll stay away from there. If he's a dumb amoeba, it'll take five or six. He's learned a new response, hasn't he? He stays away from that area. He subdivides. The children remember. He subdivides. The grandchildren have to learn it all over again. It persists through one binary fission, the conditioning. But not through the second. Why, I don't know. Now that's teachable mind. And an amoeba is about as primitive an animal organism as we can conceive, a single-celled animal. Question, Clyde?
An analogy. Won't every amoeba subjected to the same amount of dosage react in the same identical manner?
Yeah,
maybe
but...
Maybe some will turn by five times as against three. But... tree will respond in the same manner to erosion that the amoeba responds to a small charge.
One difference. You take a tree and you burn it, and it'll cover the burn. But the tree will never learn to shrink away from that area of heat. It will never learn to shrink away from that area of heat.
If there were a slowly generated area non-devastating
heat,
it would tend to move away from it.
Maybe. What you're saying is that the two responses are the same.
To me.
They aren't to me.
I mean, mean,
the tree never.
I know I'm wrong, Bill.
Here,
but I think
well, put it this way.
You've got to get higher than them eaves.
No, I don't. I'll draw the line right smack there. Because if you don't, you can't draw it anywhere. The tree never has to learn. The tree starts in instantly, without learning, to respond to erosion. There's no training period. There's no conditioning period. The tree has nothing to learn. It knows what to do. The amoeba has to learn. And it doesn't always take the same number of shocks to teach it. The tree instantly responds. It's a mechanical response. Now, admittedly, this gap is not great. Here, in discussing, we're discussing the seven adjutant mind spirits. And this is the lowest one. It's the spirit of intuition. Quick perception. The primitive physical and inherent reflex instincts. The only one of the adjutants to function so largely in the lower orders of animal life, and the only one to make extensive functional contact with the non-teachable levels of mechanical mind. There is an overlap here, Clint.
Well, now,
there's an overlap.
I'm at peace with
yeah.
Myself.
This is the twilight zone. Now, if you show me an algae, I think we got non-teachable. If you show me a sponge, I throw up my hands. You show me an amoeba, I say we've got the first of the lowest adjutants.
Why do you throw up your hands at a sponge?
I think a sponge is a borderline organism. I don't know whether it's a vegetable or an animal.
A sponge is more highly developed than your organism.
Yes, and in many ways it's very vegetable-like.
Right, but it will show animal responses.
And it'll also show vegetable responses.
Well, maybe it's just a bigger brain. Back to your overlap. Okay.
We're in a gray area here. But to me, the conditioning of the amoeba, the teaching of the amoeba to do something it never did before, this is learning.
But the fact that it's the first generation to be next, I did not know would respond instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
But
the second generation, you got to teach the grandchildren over again. The second subdivision, that it has no carryover. Now, we come up through, starting with the spirit of intuition, or reflex action, we come up through four more levels of mind, which are mammalian, and which man shares with his blood kin, the mammals. Understanding, courage, knowledge, and counsel. Now, the description here in this book is given mostly in terms of the human use of these aspects of mind. Understanding, I'm on page 402, incidentally, if you want to follow me. Understanding the impulse of coordination. Spontaneous and apparently automatic association of ideas. The gift of the coordination of acquired knowledge, phenomenon of quick reason, rapid judgment, prompt decision. Hunches, intuition, a sudden grasp of the situation, producing a proper motor response to the stimulus of danger, or the lure of food, or what have you. Courage. The fidelity endowment. In personal beings, the basis of character acquirement. But wait a minute. Let's go back now to the animal. The dog. Who stands with you? The mother mammal who'll die for her young, something the father mammals know nothing about. And incidentally, I think one of the basic differences between how men and women love children, women love babies twice men once. Man and woman loves a child humanly for what the child will be, but the mother also has mammalian love for that child. And I think you could differentiate it best if you put a question. We are now going to change the rate of growth on children. You have a choice. You want them to grow half as fast or twice as fast. The women will vote for the slower growth, and the men will vote for the faster growth. I think that would be pretty generally true, wouldn't it? Men are impatient to see the man and the boy, and the woman regrets the passing of the baby. You see, a man knows no mammalian love for his children. He has only human love. A woman has all that the man has, plus the love of a female mammal for her young. That's something no man knows a darn thing about. The dog doesn't acquire character. The personal creature acquires character, but the dog shows fidelity. When enlightened by facts and inspired by truth, this becomes the secret of the urge of evolutionary ascension for the channels of intelligent and conscientious self-direction. But this pertains to people, not to animals. And then knowledge. The curiosity mother of adventure and discovery, the scientific spirit, the guide and faithful associate of the spirits of courage and counsel, the urge to direct the endowments of courage into useful and progressive paths of growth. They're talking about a people here, not an animal. But yet the animal has the same function on a subpersonal level. And remember, when we look at the higher mammals, we are apt to project much more personality into them than they have. Because we are personal creatures, they are subpersonal creatures. They have individuality, but I don't think they're nearly as personal as we think they are. We project personal qualities into the mammal. He has identity, individuality that's unique. Then we have the spirit of counsel. Now, this is the herd instinct. And I would say this. I think as you ascend the mammalian scale, the animal scale, I think you have these adjutants swinging in as mind becomes more complex with the evolution of the cortex. I don't think any animal has the spirit of counsel unless you can demonstrate the herd instinct operating there. Whales have it. They go in schools. If you have a gaggle of geese, a pride of lions, isn't it wonderful all those different words they have for groups? A pack of wolves, a herd of cows. That's the herd instinct. Now, as you go down the scale into the sub-mammalian levels of animal life, I question that you have the herd instinct. Sharks do not herd. Fish do not herd. Birds do. The bird, I think, represents another high level of animal evolution, along with the mammal. A totality or sixth reality level. And it is this factor which constitutes experiential identity. When you stop with five adjutants, you don't stop. The animal achieves an identity, which is a sixth value, not the sixth adjutant, but a totally of the first five. What I'm reading here is from the discussion of Spornagia. These are animals up on the architectural world that we'll visit someday. And this identity is capable of experiencing reincarnation. And these are the only beings in all creation that reincarnate. When the old animal body wears out, they set up a new body and they move this animal across. And it's the same animal in notion. And it's that sixth value which constitutes animal identity.
Is there any example of your sixth, the totality of the five on an evolutionary plan?
Only as you know animals, and you know that one dog is not like another dog, or one cat like another cat. Now,
your specific reference was to Spornagia.
Yeah. But they make a general statement there. They don't say this is true only in Spornagia. Now, I think this sixth value in the higher mammal, like the dog or the horse, to name two that we have the greatest contact with, this is there. But I think as we know this animal, I think we invest that quality with a lot more personality than is there, because we are persons. Then we come to the seventh adjutant. And here we separate animals from people. Right. At the sixth adjutant level. The spirit of worship. It says that concerning these Spornagia, it's a rather touching statement here. These Spornagia have a vision which permits them to recognize, in addition to material beings, the Marantia creations, the lower angelic orders, midway creatures, and some of the lower orders of spirit personalities. They do not comprehend the worship of the infinite, nor do they grasp the import of the eternal, but they do, through affection for their masters, join in the outward spiritual devotions of their realm. The dog went to church with you. The dog went to school with you. That doesn't mean he can be educated. We want to be with. The spirit of worship is an interesting item or function to find in mind. This shows that mind is spirit kin. This is the essential dividing line between animals and people. And it explains why the human race is incurably worshipful. If you've got a true human being, you have an instinct to reach out to worship. And then you have the seventh adjutant, the spirit of wisdom. Now, at first blush, you might say, well, now, wait a minute. Worship, being more spiritual than wisdom, should come last. That's a higher function. We're talking about mind, not spirit. And the highest function of mind is discrimination. Andon, who with a sister were the first two human beings, Andon came close to worshiping fire because it was so useful on cold days. But wisdom directed him that fire was not a suitable object for worship, because he could create it. And he picked the sun as a more worthy symbol. And as between fire and the sun, I think we'd all agree, Andon picked a better symbol for the object of worship. So wisdom has to come after worship if we're dealing with mind. They make a wonderful statement. Wisdom is the acme of intellectual performance. Wisdom is the goal of a purely mental and moral existence. But remember their definition of morality. Morality is super mammalian, but sub-spiritual. People are moral beings. Angel people are spiritual beings, or moving in that direction. That's just a crazy simple definition we have for levels of function. Animal people, and angel people. The most that a person can be, strictly as a human being, sub-spiritually, is wise and moral. And from a temporal standpoint, those are real qualifications on which you can construct a spiritual life. And without that foundation, be darned if I know how you can build. Now, we got to move on. When's your due date?
I have to go just about an hour from now.
All right. This mind ministry comes from the local universe creative spirit.
Yeah. Before I have to leave. That's not going to have to be there. I could be here for an hour.
For an hour. Okay, we'll finish it. These adjutants are not people. They are emanations from her presence. They are levels of her consciousness. She sends these adjutants into the evolutionary worlds. They make contact with us. I think of their function as, let's take a long manila clothesline. Put a loop in the clothesline. That's Clyde Goodman's mind. That loop. It's part of the circuit, but it's an individualized portion of the circuit. What maintains the loop? The living cortex. And when death supervenes, there is nothing there to keep the loop. It pulls out. The loop is gone. The circuit is intact, but that particular loop is gone. But as long as life persists in that cortex, that will maintain that loop. And as new cortices, or I guess that's the plural, are born, they form other loops in this circuit. Seven clotheslines, all looped in there. Yeah. I think they, well, practically speaking, JB, as we unify mind, it's like a different strand. Seven different strands in one line. But the amoeba has only one strand. We have seven.
He only utilizes.
Right. Our first cousins, the secondary midwayers, and it was they who rolled away the stone from in front of Jesus' tomb, they're physical beings, but not corporeal. They tell us if our eyes were just a little more acute, we'd see them. They're kind of up in the ultraviolet band, you know. If we could see just a little more, they'd be visible to us. No, ma'am, and if I ever do, I'm going to run like hell. No, ma'am. But I think they'd register on a fluoroscope. But you'd have to catch the midwayer. And since they can move with the velocity of light, I'm sure that they will never be seen on the fluoroscope unless they want to cooperate. They're living electrical patterns. When I try to visualize a midwayer, here's what I visualize. I let a human being's flesh and bones dissolve until I've got nothing left but the cortex and the nervous system. Then I dissolve the cortex and the nervous system and merely leave the electricity there, the neuricity. And this, to me, is the best visualization of the living pattern of a midwayer. No, it's pretty big. Mm-hmm. the thing that maintains that pattern is life, the same thing that maintains the pattern of our body. When life dies, the body disintegrates. Let's kill Clyde off today, shall we? When Clyde kicks the bucket, as we all will sooner or later, the loops pull out of these lines. And when they reassemble Goodman on the first mansion world, they've got to give him a new type of mind. Without taking my anthropomorphism seriously, I'm very anthropomorphic in my pictures, because this is the only thing you can feel. And I always think of this place as very much like a morgue. And I can see a marble slab, and they've gone over to the local quartermaster department, and they've drawn out one GI body, sodium chloride pattern, suitable for people from our type of planet. And it's lying there, a little drippy. They pulled it out of the brine. And they got to have some place to store these things. And it awaits Goodman's arrival. One seraphim shows up with Clyde's soul in a rather ragged and highly embryonic condition. He just made it with the skin of his teeth. The Oklahoma Urantia Society prayed real hard, and that tipped the scales. Besides, I didn't want to disappoint Frankie. And the seraphim deposits the soul in the appropriate spot. The thought adjuster returns. They loop a mind circuit in there. The life carrier catalyzes life. Life carriers don't bestow life, but they're catalytic agents. It's transmitted through them. They're master biologists. And then from no place that anybody can identify, Goodman's personality shows up. And this is the big mystery of survival. Where has the personality been? They can identify it as the old personality. They've taken stencilings of the old personality. They can show that this is the same personality, but they do not know where mortal personality is between death and reawakening. They can account for everything else. Goodman's personality shows up and seizes this mind circuit. That's the return of consciousness. That's right. This is when you wake up. And you say, where am I? Yeah, dry me off. Hand me a towel. Now, this is not an adjutant circuit. When Berkeley wakes up there, she's going to sit on the edge of the slab and say, I miss my adjutants. Where are they? Burke has a feeling that these adjutants are a lot more active than the type of mind that we'll receive up there. She may be right. I wouldn't dispute it with her. You can take either side of that argument, I think. But this is a new type of mind. It is wholly divorced from the mammalian level of existence. Our midware friends, for example, have the top two adjutants, but none of the first five. A midware is a human being minus all mammalian qualities. Secondary midware. Pure nervous system. No body. This is a 110-volt mind. I'm going to use voltage here for crude illustration. This same creative spirit who gives us our adjutant mind, I think, acts as a transformer. She draws on the super universe circuits of mind, which operate at 440 volts. She downsteps this to 110 for Marantia uses. I think the normal local universe mind voltage might be 220, the super universe voltage 440. And we gradually evolve up through the local universe using this type of mind, Marantia mind. until we can become spiritual beings. Now, we'll have this type of growth in our local universe career. We will even out mind differentials. I'm pretty sure that by the time we leave the local universe, we will test out as being at about the same level of intellectual capabilities. I don't think we'll all have the same aptitudes. I think some of us will be a little better in science than we are in aesthetics. Hello, Minnie. In aesthetics. And some will be a little better mathematicians, perhaps, than we are verbally. But in the overall, let's put it this way. When we average out our scholastic grades, they'll be comparable. Some of us will have A's in some subjects and B's in others, and others will have A's in those subjects and B's in the others. But I don't think we will differ too much in the sense that we do now. Some people are quick of thinking, some people are slow of thinking. When we get up to the super universe, we encounter 440 volts. Direct. We're now primitive spirits, first aid spirit beings. We now are getting mind as it's ministered by the seven master spirits. You'll recall, the simplest description I can give of the seven master spirits is this. The infinite spirit sat down, painted a picture of the universal father. That's master spirit number one. Then he painted a picture of the Eternal Son, Master Spirit number two. Then he painted a self-portrait, Master Spirit number three. Then he painted a composite portrait of the Father and Son, Master Spirit number four. Then he painted a composite portrait of the Father and himself, Master Spirit number five. Then he painted a composite portrait of the Son and himself, number six. Then he painted a composite portrait of triune deity, number seven. These are the portraitures which the infinite spirit has made of the three paradise deities. We will get mind of a finite nature which is ministered by the master spirit of our super universe, number seven, the composite of all three. And that's what we'll think with all the way to paradise. What we think with in Havona is intriguing. In Havona, there are seven circuits, you'll recall, each one of which is pervaded by a circuit spirit. And it speaks of the 12 mind adjutants of the circuit spirits in Havona. And that's about all we know about them. Except to me, the use of the word adjutants is very significant. And I think this 12-fold adjutant ministry of mind is analogous to the 7-fold adjutant ministry of mind as we go through Havona. What we think with when we get on paradise, I don't know, but I suspect it's still the cosmic mind. Now, you folks will have to forgive us, but these people want to go farther. We are not going to hang from skyhooks on Pink Cloud 27. The third source and center ministers absolute mind, existential mind. The cosmic mind is finite, I think, and is centered in the seven master spirits. Now, with the beginning of the experiential universe, in the dawn of time, the infinite spirit bestowed the mind of the supreme upon the supreme. About this same period, the infinite spirit also bestowed supreme ultimate mind. My warrant for that is the discussion of the origin of solitary messengers, who are thought to be the personality repercussions of the bestowal of supreme ultimate mind. And again, this is in the dawn of time, the twilight of eternity, the near times of eternity, Those are synonymous statements. If that be true, then I think the mind of the ultimate, transcendental mind, was bestowed at the same time. This statement is not found in the papers, but it's bracketed. If the supreme mind of the supreme below and of the supreme ultimate above was bestowed in the dawn of time, then I think middle mind, the mind of obscenity, was bestowed at that same time. In other words, I think at the dawn of time, the source of absolute mind made the complete endowment of experiential mind for all future time. Now, the evolutionary supreme was in no condition to receive this endowment. Didn't have a bucket big enough. This bucket is growing. Could catch a bucket full, but he couldn't catch a barrel full. What the supreme being could not receive was held in escrow for him by the seven master spirits, and is being fed out as fast as he can receive it. In the meantime, we'll see what this says first. I couldn't remember it last time. In the meantime, Majestan is experiencing this factualizing mind of the Supreme as a time-space experience. But Majestan is not the trustee of that which is held in escrow. The seven master spirits are the trustees. It's merely the infinite spirit isn't going to feed this to the supreme piecemeal. He'll give it to him in one chunk. And what the supreme could not receive, the seven master spirits held in custody for him, and they're feeding it out as he develops capacity to receive it.
Look on page 1272.
Read it, Burke.
Majestan appeared and has ever since focalized the cosmic presence of the supreme mind, while the master spirit continues as source centers for the far-flung ministry of the cosmic mind.
Right. Repository
focalized.
Of the supreme mind. Focalized.
The cosmic presence of the supreme mind.
Well, regardless of who has custody, someone does, because the Supreme can't receive it all. This mind of the Supreme is unifying the power aspects with a spirit person of the Supreme. There is an analogous function in the mind of the ultimate. Quicker than I will in the other place. Unifying phases must refer to some action of ultimate mind that unifies the omnipotent with the ultimate, as on finite levels the supreme mind unifies the almighty with God the supreme. That's as near as I can come to establishing the fact of ultimate mind. But if there is supreme ultimate mind and supreme mind, I think there must be ultimate.
Ultimate
and supreme ultimate. They're not limited to the finite
That's
level.
Right. They're qualified to operate.
we forget that because most of the description of their functions pertains to the finite.
I remember that now.
Said the potential for expansion and growth be held by the seven magic spirits.
I think so.
The word focalize is used in Majeston now would be transmitter. I mean, if you focalize it in there.
I think it's already actualized.
Mm-hmm.
But if the seven master spirits are fizzing it out as the supreme is emerging, and it is focalized in Majeston, Majeston could be a type of transmitter.
Could be. Certainly he's the point where it converges.
Right. It's focalized
yeah.
there. And the source I bring is like where Bill said.
We can become conscious, I think, of the difference between mind and spirit. Have you known somebody who wasn't too bright, and yet you thought they were a wonderful person? You don't particularly admire them for their quick perception, but you sense, you taste real value in that person. Dependability, honesty, loyalty. This is a guy you'd like to have with you when the going was tough. You know what I mean? I'm not sure that this flavor of worth is all spiritual. It could be moral as well as spiritual. Fidelity to duty is not a spirit trait. It's a moral quality. When we're told this is super animal but sub-spiritual. But what you are tasting, I think, is a mix of the moral and the spiritual. But it's certainly not intellectual, is it? One of the lowest IQs I ever measured was in a person that I felt was one of the most tremendous human beings I've ever talked to. And he's not pretty. He's a humble guy who just worked his damn fool head off. And I felt this is a great guy. I haven't got much to talk to him about, but I admired that man. Tremendously. And I can prove he's not bright.
He's like ornate.
Look at our civilization. From an intellectual standpoint, a scientific standpoint, unquestionably the most advanced civilization this planet has ever seen. But it's kooky, isn't it? Along with our advances, we have deliberately killed, through warfare, directly and indirectly, more people than have been killed in a long time by natural causes. Here you can see the sterility of the purely intellectual approach. People sensed something more than mind. A good example is medieval law in its most primitive form. One could throw himself upon the mercy of the duke. This is Norman law, particularly. Now, why did they say that? They had a feeling that there was something in a duke, a human being with authority, that would respond to a plea for justice. The Duke accepted this. The inhabitants of the duchy accepted this. We forget how blandly we assume basic decency in people. This is a bland assumption of moral and spiritual qualities. Most people are honest. If this were not true, then why is defalcation front page news? If this were not true, then honesty would be news. Honesty is not news. Domestic tranquility is not news. But if Mike throws the kitchen stove at Maggie and she throws a cleaver at Mike, this is news. The untranquil is news. Peace is not news. War is.
This is your medieval thinking, though. You're in early English. Norm and things also include Satan.
Oh, sure. Although there's been less acceptance of fate in Western civilization than in any other civilization. See, theologically, among the Greeks, the highest god was never master of fate. He was subject to it. But in Western Christendom, God is the master of fate.
From the time we leave the local universe, or even before, mind would have a different function than it has now.
I think basically it's our arena of consciousness. And where we make our decisions, and the mediator between the divergence between matter and spirit.
But we've fused the material and the spirit.
No, they haven't.
At that time.
Material and spirit haven't fused.
Well, I don't know.
That's not material.
Well, it's more material and spirit.
It's a blend of the two, and it's becoming spiritual.
But it's fused with the fragment of the Father.
Right.
And then the function of mind wouldn't try to be unifying because they are unified. Mind would be more consciousness and
that's
thinking
right.
And perceiving and knowing and intellect would not for unification.
Let me read you something. 16, if you want to follow it. Material evolution has provided you a life machine, your body. The Father himself has endowed you with the purest spirit reality known in the universe, your thought adjuster. But into your hands, subject to your own decisions, has been given mind, and it is by mind that you live or die. It is within this mind and with this mind that you make those moral decisions which enable you to achieve adjuster likeness, and that is godlikeness. Mortal mind is a temporary intellect system loaned to human beings for use during a material lifetime. And as they use this mind, they are either accepting or rejecting the potential of eternal existence. Mind is about all you have of universe reality that is subject to your will, and the soul will faithfully portray the harvest of the temporal decisions which the mortal self is making. Human consciousness rests gently upon the electrochemical mechanism below and delicately touches the spirit Marantia energy system above. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore, must he work with mind, of which he is conscious. And it is not so much what mind comprehends as what mind desires to comprehend that ensures survival. It is not so much what mind is like as what mind is striving to be like that constitutes spirit identification. It is not so much that man is conscious of God as that man yearns for God that results in universe ascension. What you are today is not so important as what you are becoming, day by day, and in eternity. Mind is the cosmic instrument on which the human will can play the discords of destruction, or upon which the same human will can bring forth the exquisite melodies of God identification and consequent eternal survival. The adjuster bestowed upon man is in the last analysis impervious to evil and incapable of sin. But mortal mind can actually be twisted, distorted, and rendered evil and ugly by the sinful machinations of a perverse and self-seeking human will. Likewise can this mind be made noble, beautiful, true and good, actually great, in accordance with the spirit-illuminated will of a God-knowing human being. Evolutionary mind is only fully stable and dependable when manifesting itself upon the two extremes of cosmic intellectuality, the wholly mechanized and the entirely spiritualized. Between the intellectual extremes of pure mechanical control and true spirit nature, there intervenes that enormous group of evolving and ascending minds whose stability and tranquility are dependent upon personality choice and spirit identification. Mind is your ship. The adjuster is your pilot. The human will is captain. That's a great analogy. The master of the mortal vessel should have the wisdom to trust the divine pilot to guide the ascending soul into the Marantia harbors of eternal survival. Only by selfishness, slothfulness, and sinfulness can the will of man reject the guidance of such a loving pilot and eventually wreck the mortal career upon the evil shoals of rejected mercy and upon the rocks of embraced sin. With your consent, this faithful pilot will safely carry you across the barriers of time and the handicaps of space to the very source of the divine mind and on beyond, even to the paradise father of adjusters. The material mind of mortal man is the cosmic loom that carries the Marantia fabrics on which the indwelling thought adjuster threads the spirit patterns of a universe character of enduring values and divine meanings, a surviving soul of ultimate destiny and unending career, a potential finality. Mind is our people.
Where is it that we've got now?
Hmm? in my language, are you honest of heart, and have you got courage? The papers put it, sincerity in decisions. If you're sincere, you're honest. You're perfectly willing to take a look at yourself and say, well, I've made a big damn fool of myself. Now, this is not the way to do it, see. You would put honesty above pride. You'd be perfectly willing to say, I was wrong. And then if you've got courage, you'll try. You'll get in motion. And even if you start out in the wrong direction, you can steer the ship. But you've got to get out of harbor to go anyplace. The papers say that the keys of the kingdom are sincerity, and more sincerity. All men have these keys. Later on, they say, man makes progress in the kingdom by decisions, and by more decisions. I translate those into two words, honesty and courage. To me, this book presents a colossal challenge to men. I've used this illustration before. I visualize our port of entry as a kind of a cosmic Ellis Island. And I symbolize the actual entrance as an archway. And there's two bronze tablets, one on each pillar. And on one side it says, we don't want any panty wastes. And on the other tablet it says, no SOBs need apply either. And that's the straight and narrow. Can you be courageous without being an SOB? And can you be meek without being a pantywaist? To me, this puts a tremendous premium on courage. One place it says, before we get to this perfect universe near the center of all things, it says, long since we will have learned to feast upon uncertainty, to get fat on disappointment, to invigorate in the presence of difficulty, and to exhibit indomitable courage when confronted with the inexplicable. It says, long since, our battle cry will have become, in liaison with God, nothing, absolutely nothing is impossible. That's challenging. Reading this morning in a little bit in the Maranshi Life, which is, there's a couple of sections in here I think are pretty great because they apply right here and now. Can you learn to accept challenges without complaint and to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear? 555. It's a hard number to remember. They will ask, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? If you succeed, will you maintain a well-balanced poise, a stabilized and spiritualized attitude throughout every effort in the long struggle to break the fetters of material inertia to attain the freedom of spirit existence? It seems to me they're almost as worried about success as failure. And as you look at what success does to people, it's almost to be feared. Even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments. And they will point out that sometimes your most disappointing disappointments have become your greatest blessings. Sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death, the death of your fondest hopes, before it can be reborn to bear the fruits of new life and new opportunity. and from them you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment. First, by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities. And then, by accepting your lot when you faithfully performed your duty. Gee, that's a big chunk of wisdom there. You will learn that you increase your burdens and decrease the likelihood of success by taking yourself too seriously. Nothing can take precedent over the work of your status sphere, this world or the next. Very important is the work of preparation for the next higher sphere, but nothing equals the importance of the world, of the work of the world, in which you are actually living. But though the work is important, the self is not. When you feel important, you lose energy to the wear and tear of ego dignity, so that there is little energy left to do the work. Self-importance, not work importance, exhausts immature creatures. It is the self-element that exhausts, not the effort to achieve. You can do important work if you do not become self-important. You can do several things as easy as one if you leave yourself out. Variety is restful. Monotony is what wears and exhausts. Day after day is alike. Just life or the alternative of death. Golly, that's down to earth. Can you accept challenges without complaint? Can you face difficulties and uncertainties without fear? They're recruiting, they're not recruiting a bunch of harp players here. They're recruiting for something rugged, challenging, stimulating, which is going to test everything you have periodically. Because as we grow, it seems to me obvious that our problems will grow. Consider a practical example. Jesus faced problems which none of us are called upon to face. He had a much greater capacity. He developed a greater capacity than we have, and his problems grew in magnitude. Consider how beneficial was the contact of the 12 with Jesus. Consider their afterlife. Were they rosy and smooth, or were they rugged, challenging, even tragic? Their problems grew along with their growth. Jesus didn't challenge the Alpheus twins as he challenged Peter. The Alpheus twins weren't very bright boys. They were very fine people. He challenged them to go back and return to their old jobs, fishermen. He told Peter to be a shepherd. The more you grow, the more adventuresome I think you can depend that life will be. And why not? You're more sensitive to life. The more you grow, the more your ear becomes attuned to new notes in the wild, wonderful melody of life. And you respond to more. Is not a vice president who absconded with $1 million. It's the vice president who put it in a safety deposit box and wouldn't risk it. He came back and says, here's your $1 million. See? Exactly what you gave me. I was scared to death. And what happened to him? He got fired. And they called in the first VP that had made the biggest killing of all, and he says, here, you put this money to work. This parable illustrates slothfulness, not wickedness. The guy didn't steal, he just didn't venture. What is it they call the cardinal sins of human beings? Remember?
Procrastination.
Equivocation. Problem avoidance. Unfairness. Ease seeking.
So the person has absolute faith, has absolute independent faith. And they're confronted with a problem. So then they say to themselves, I know that God will help me through this in some of the way. As opposed to saying, I welcome this problem.
This is why the adjutant of wisdom is above the adjutant of worship. If the human being says, I have faith and I will wait for God's solution, then in time, that human being will learn that there's a type of problem that God won't solve. And he will learn to discriminate. When my children were very small, they asked me how to pray. And I said, you have two fathers. We do. Yes, I said, you have me and you have your Father in heaven. And I made it clear that the basic difference was how we registered on the sensorium. You can't see, hear, feel, touch, or taste the Father in heaven. And then we discussed the objectives of prayer. Things we want. And if it's a physical thing, then I said, you talk to me. Now I said, God could get it for you, but in my observation, he doesn't. And I'm pretty sure. And I think I know why. He's delegated these responsibilities. And if he didn't, I would never have the experience of being a father. He could do a better job than I can do. But he wants me to have this experience. So if you want an electric train or a baseball mitt, or a doll, please don't ask your other father. That's my responsibility. But if you want something that we can't feel, and instantly, what's that? Kindness, courage, all the wonderful intangibles, happiness. I said, don't ask me for these things. I don't know how to make you these gifts. You'll have to talk to your other father about those things. This is where wisdom eventually will help our faithful but unwise believer to discriminate between those things which have been delegated and those things which he should ask for. You see, if he prays, and if he's honest, and if he's got courage, he'll work out this problem. The first problem will result in disaster. He will wait for God, and God probably won't do a damn thing.